The consciousness expands into different fields. So after the anamaya comes the pranamaya, where the consciousness is becoming expanded into another field, where you realize that I'm alive and I have to protect my life, you know, somehow or other, or I need protection. In the beginning, the baby takes shelter of whom he feels secure will protect him. Most of the children, some children are unusual, but most of the children, they will not go to others than the parents, who they don't know, they will not go to. And that is for this reason of pranamaya, they're protecting their life like this. And so as the consciousness grows up in this pranamaya, he starts being able to protect himself. Nowadays, even children in schools, they're very anxious to take karate classes so that they can protect themselves, you know. And you can see them going with their little jackets and trousers to the classes. And then as in adulthood, the same thing as with anamaya and pranamaya also. One concerns himself not only with one's own protection, but the protection of his own family, the family that he has himself, and later on the nation, etc. And in this way, consciousness expands. So the anamaya and pranamaya is basically concerned with the bodily needs and like that. So in other parts of the Vedas, there's different description of the basic needs. These ones are two of them, but there's two more which are basic needs, and that is sleeping and also procreation. So they can be kind of under this category, they can be taken in this category of anamaya and pranamaya. So then it goes on to the level of manomaya, where the mental condition becomes very active and stimulated by thoughts, feelings, and desires. And in the beginning, in childhood, the thoughts go around little things like toys the feeling of a little girl is a little different than the feeling of a little boy. The boy likes to wrestle and, you know, with his friends, and the girl likes to play with dolls and like that. And the desires are accordingly a little different. And something very typical for the mental condition is also two things, and that is acceptance and rejectance. Sometimes we may accept something to be very nice and favorable, but the same thing we may reject at another situation, in another situation. Like, for example, in summer, you may not want to take a hot bath. Maybe a cool bath is very nice. But then that same thing, if it gets a little colder, you would like to rather have a warm bath. So the mind always accepts, rejects, you know, this is not favorable, I don't like this at this time, you know. It is very whimsical in that way. So sometimes there's good reasoning behind it, and sometimes due to emotions and feelings, it is whimsical also, like that. So, and in teenagers, in young adulthood and teenagers, the desires are again a little different. We are getting into education we are preparing for, we are contemplating the, you know, marriage, etc. So then, and as we're growing up, when we are settled in marriage and we have a family, then again our interests become a little different and the mental conditions become a little different too. We're having responsibility now, and our emotions revolve around family life, raising children, and whatever's involved in that. And then as we are, as our mental minds become more and more active, we are starting to get into education, higher education, and finally we may become even professionals and getting into science and technology, etc., and into very intricate fields of knowledge about this material world, etc. And then, as we're getting a little older, maybe around about 40 or so, then gradually something comes up, like philosophical, for some people it may be earlier also, because understanding that we had many lifetimes, every person is a little different, and more or less advanced on that level. So some people very quickly evolve to that stage, but some people may never in this lifetime, and some people may come to the position where they start philosophically researching, why am I here, what will be after death, and why I have to suffer, why certain people enjoy and others have hardships, like that. So many questions that we have about life and afterlife, like that. So, and sometimes this we becoming very addicted even to this kind of mental speculation to say, you know, what afterlife could be. I can remember when I was a child, we had in the Christian church a play about afterlife. And in Christianity, there's not very much knowledge about the next life. So it's very speculative. It was like, I remember the cantor of our church. He's the person that is in charge of the playing the organ and conducting the orchestra, like that. But he was a very, very deep kind of a person, you know. And I always looked up to him as a teenager. And he was a person on the operation table. And so when he was operated, then he had some kind of afterlife experience. And but the speculation in that was that now looking back, at that time I was thinking it was fabulous. I loved that drama. But in now then thinking back, it was very speculative because it was, you know, he was meeting again all his relatives and friends in the afterlife and God was there also, but God was not the main kind of, you know, it was mainly the friends and relatives kind of thing, you know, but in a different condition, you know. But it was very vague, you know. So when I then came to Krishna consciousness, I could understand this mental speculation is actually not getting us anywhere. You know, this deductive knowledge of trying to reach the, understand the Supreme by one's own mental power is actually not very effective. So then coming in contact with the bona fide spiritual master, we understand that actually knowledge descends, spiritual knowledge descends, is given to us by the mercy of the spiritual master and the guru and Krishna. So now we are coming to the Vijnanamaya, which is the intellectual consciousness. As we are growing up, our intelligence becomes more and more utilized. Now here you see this is called Vijnanamaya, which is translated into English as intelligence. Vijnan is intellect. Yeah. But actually in the Sanskrit language, there's two words for this. So the English is not really sufficient to explain this. There's Gyan and there's Vijnan. Now, Gyan is what you may understand as the material sciences, you know, understanding material knowledge. So, and that is called, in a strict sense, according to the Vedas, Vijnan is not material sciences. Vijnan is actually higher realizations on spirituality. But the Gyan is called Shilpa, which is strictly translated as craftsmanship or craftsmanship. And there's an example in the Vedas about that, about Maya Danava. I don't know if you've seen the Mahabharata, and I don't know if you have read the Mahabharata. There's an incident where Indra burned the Kandava forest and there was the fight between the demigods and And Arjuna was victorious in that, and he saved a demon called Maya Danava. And this Maya Danava, then later on, in gratitude for having his life saved, he built the Raj Sabha for King Yudhishthira and the five Pandavas. And in this Raj Sabha, that was he was an architect of a of great craftsmanship. So much so, he was an architect. He had architectural skills which reached into the subtle fields of physics, and you know, and into subtle sciences. He was able to create land where the water where there was land. And it was not recognized. Only the in this Raj Sabha and Raj Bhavan, only the Pandavas were able to recognize this, and how everything was properly constructed, and even where there was walls, you would see sometimes scenery, garden sceneries. You know, so you would be thinking that it was open. You could go out. Like this. So when Duryodhana came to this Raj Sabha to see his cousins for his dubious purposes, he had no such understanding where what was situated. So he was immediately marching in, not waiting for being welcomed or whatever. You know, he was directly marching in. And as he was marching in, he fell into water, what he thought was land. And Draupadi was on the balcony, and she was seeing that, and he was saying, "You're the son of a blind man. You're just as blind. You're just as blind," or something. She was laughing at him, and that was then later on creating a lot of disturbance and some other controversies. So he had some fantastic. This Maya Danava had some fantastic understanding about this science of architecture, and you may think, you know, this is. He's not a scientist, you know. He doesn't have a wonderful intellect. This is considered to the according to the Vedas just shilpa gyan. Shilpa gyan means workmanship, craftsmanship, something with which you earn your livelihood. So nowadays also, unless there's some spiritual understanding and of spiritual. Higher understanding of spirituality, this is considered shilpa gyan, even though it may be very detailed and very scientific from a material point of view. So, you know, you see sometimes in the material world that there may be great scientists and they have such great skills, but nevertheless in their private life they're acting very foolish, you know, very degraded and foolish. Or even if they are not foolish, maybe they succumb easily to anger, to pride, or, you know, I have so much knowledge, I'm better than everyone else, and I'm going to exploit everyone else, you know, like that. So very low-class kind of consciousness behind that, even though they're so educated, you know. One of our brahmacharis went once to the IIT and gave a class on anger management, and one of the leading professors was congratulating him afterwards and saying, you know, although I am teaching many students here in this college and etc., but when it comes to dealing with my students and even with my colleagues, I get very angry. I easily, and I can't control myself, so I'm very glad that you gave this class. So this is a case where you can see that a person is scientifically maybe advanced, but this is all that's all part of the manomai consciousness, you know. It is part of the lower part of consciousness, which concerns itself with the body and the mind. You know, like for example, the anamaya, pranamaya are within the manomaya as well. So there is some consciousness, I want to earn money, therefore I'm going to take up really good education so that I can afford something that others can't, like that, and I will be better situated than everyone else. And he feels himself to be very advanced because of it. But real advancement, according to the Vedas, is Vigyan. And that is the next step here. Oh, I wanted to give some more examples in terms of Gyan and Vigyan. Now, the difference between Gyan and Vigyan then means the underlying objective with what we're doing things in life. Like if our objective in learning some fantastic sciences and taking some knowledge is simply to get some of this Shilpa Gyan or some great profession by which we can earn livelihood, then this is not so valuable. But if we're utilizing our knowledge for advancing spiritually, then this will come to your own benefit. So Prabhupada always gives an example of the vulture. A vulture goes very high in the sky. He can go sometimes 1 or 2 kilometers up into the sky or even higher. And he can still see from up there what is down on the ground. So that is something that we even can do as human beings, to see something at such far distance. So he has a qualification that is even better than ours. So you may say, oh well, if that is our measurement, you know, to have some fantastic advantages over others, then I would say the vulture is even better than a human being, and as far as the sight is concerned. So we should give him credit. He is a great person, right? No. But what is his objective? That is what we have to see. What is his objective? He goes into the sky to see what? To see carcass down, to see a dead body. Where's the dead body? So in material life, if we are gaining knowledge for some very puny motive, then is that really worth your effort? Is that really worth your effort? So therefore, the Vedic scriptures, they encourage us to climb a little higher, to come to the Vigyan platform, Vigyanmay platform, to the truly intellectual platform. So this intellectual consciousness is typified by discrimination, vivek buddhi. You know, we start discriminating what is a good path to pursue, and in this, that means we have passed through all these stages of mental speculation. And one of the stages in mental speculation is coming as far as to the platform where we're thinking that we are God ourselves. That is this Mayavad philosophy that propounds that everything is Maya in this material world, and actually we are all God ourselves. It's just we have fallen into illusion. When we're coming out of that illusion again, we're coming to our status of God like this. So this is called mental speculation, and it is considered, according to the Vedas, it's the last snare of Maya. Maya always presents different traps. So if we don't want to surrender to God, we want to be, you know, the greatest, and like we don't want to surrender to anyone, we may find this a very attractive philosophy. But to a person who's already a little spiritually advanced, maybe from past lives, etc., he's not attracted to that. He will be more curious to see, you know, he can see that there's powers in nature, etc., and that I'm helpless, and that everything is done actually for me. And whatever we are taking the sunshine, we are taking the benefit of the moonshine for the vegetation to grow, and so that we can get our nourishment. We're taking so many benefits all around. So who's providing all this? You know, so we're becoming like that conscious, and we see that. So in this developing conscious platform of Vigyanmay, one becomes very attracted and gains faith to take to take shelter of spiritual authorities and scriptures, which talk about, which analyze these factors of life. Like, for example, we're seeing someone dying and we're seeing someone alive. So then we're seeing what is the difference between the two. We cannot see the difference. We means other than that in one is no life and the other not. But what has gone away from there? We cannot see that thing that is left like that. So what is it? So we become very curious. So when we hear from authoritative scriptures what this about these spiritual subject matters, we gain faith. We have faith in them. And we like to take spiritual authorities. And just by this faith, that is the beginning of this Vigyanmoy platform. And gradually, that leads us to get to the association of sadhus. In the association of sadhus, they're representing God and the scriptures about God. We are making more and more progress to the point that we are getting practical realizations about how we are not this body, how we are this soul. And gradually, participating more in spiritual activities, chanting the holy name of the Lord, etc., our consciousness grows and grows and grows. We are starting to see that even spirituality is a science in itself, and that, like in any science, we have to learn it and we have to recognize the pitfalls and the do's and the don'ts, vidhi, nishedh, and we are trying to follow nicely as it is described and recommended by spiritual authorities and by the Lord himself in Bhagavad Gita, for example, and we are making more and more progress until we come to the platform where we realize our spiritual identity. And this may be even within this lifetime. That's called Jivan Mukta, when you actually realize you're not the body and you're actually spirit soul. And then we're coming to the highest platform, which is called Anandamaya. And on that platform, we are becoming fully conscious of our spiritual identity, our relationship with the Supreme Lord. The soul is not something ethereal, non-graspable, non-visible. That is usually in the beginning of spiritual life, we have some vague ideas what the soul is. And when someone says soul, we don't see anything, you know, But later on in spiritual life, you can understand the soul is the person. The soul is the person. And on this Anandamaya platform, you have realized who that person is, what it looks like, the soul, what it is, you know, and who God is, who Krishna is, and what our relationship is between both of us, like that. And so this is called the Brahma Bhuta platform. This is described in Bhagavad Gita. Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma na sochati na kangshati sama sarvishu bhutishu mat bhakti lavate param. I can see some people here already know this also. So some students here, some devotees. So that is translated, one who is thus transcendentally situated at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments or desires to have anything. He is equally disposed towards every living entity, and in that state he attains pure devotional service unto me. So you may think, but we are also doing service already now for Krishna, but it is not yet pure devotional service. It is still lapses where we are selfish, like a child that starts walking. It cannot walk immediately. It will fall down again, gets up and tries again, and falls down again, until the time comes where he steadily walks from one point to the other. And so in spiritual life it is the same way. We have the intention to serve Krishna, but because we are conditioned for many lifetimes to just think of our own selfish interests, therefore we are falling back to that kind of mode every now and then. So So, but on the platform of Anandamaya, we have become steady in serving the Lord. So, there's another Bhagavad Gita verse which displays this Vigyan platform, where Krishna himself decides what he considers to be knowledge and what he considers to be ignorance. So, translates as humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching of a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home and the rest, even-mindedness, amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant unalloyed devotional service to me, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization and philosophical search for the absolute truth. All these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there may be, is ignorance. So each item I could go into detail. There's much to be said about each one of them, but I wanted to give some examples about the oncoming, the equation, right? So, which comes up soon. So, maybe when you meet after with the devotees, you can inquire if you're curious about these things. We can discuss that more. So, most of the population in the material world, they remain to stay pretty much on the Manomaya platform at most. Even though they may appear to be very sophisticated, but many of them will not even have an inkling for many, many lifetimes what this Vigyanmoya is, the true intellectual platform. So, you should not be too super impressed. I'm not trying to discourage you. You're all students, college students. I'm not trying to discourage you to become proficient in your knowledge. In fact, this is wonderful if you can utilize your material skills in the service of the Lord, and it will become very, very handy for you in future to access communication and relationships with people who are also educated, because usually people don't like to who are educated they don't like to interrelate with people who are not educated. That is one of their I would say drawbacks, that we are on that egotistical level. I've learned so much, therefore I want respect from others, but it is good if there's another also educated person who can open up further doors for these people and encourage them to also come to higher platforms. And so it is wonderful for the preaching of Krishna consciousness. Plus, if you're in a good economical situation, that means you can help others also, materially speaking, and you can also very comfortably practice your own spiritual life without any tension. Because even in spiritual life, we have to maintain our body, isn't it? So, understand this right. I'm encouraging it, in fact. I'm not discouraging it. But this is how the Vedas, explain this here. Going back to this Manomaya platform, so now, focusing on your age group, kind of, I've written up here, by the process of learning, life experiences and academical learning, the mind becomes stimulated with many thoughts. So as teenagers, as young adults, one becomes increasingly inquisitive, gets a sharp perception, starts seeing hypocrisy, duplicity and injustice. Um, uh, One is idealistic and wants to change the world for the better. This is all like very typical for a young adult like this. I'm not saying that that is not also the, you know, older people, but this is very, you know, there's a very kind of enthusiasm there to want to change the world for the better. There are many desires and a strong demand to fulfill these desires, wanting to have fun. One becomes very much concerned what the opposite sex thinks of himself. One plans out one's education with the thought to settle in future into family life. And now the sentence I want to focus in on is, if one finds oneself in a conventional situation that prevents one to fulfill one's plans and desires, one becomes angry and starts to rebel. Now, let's focus in on the rebellion part. Rebellion in the spotlight. So the dictionary says the definition of rebellion means refusal to accept some authority or code of convention. Second, an act or show of defiance towards an authority or established convention. Third, becoming more intensive, open, armed, and organized resistance to a constituted government. And here I give some synonyms. Rebelliousness, insubordination, resistance, disobedience, non-compliance, and defiance. Now that will come in later on handy for us to look at. And on the other side, now I wanted to start some examples about examples about rebellion. And I have chosen some personal examples of young adults in their lives where they're rebelling. And let me see. So there's, I got someone else to get some newspaper clippings, because I don't really enjoy to go through the newspaper. Going through the newspaper is like associating with the minds of others, kind of. And there's a lot of degradedness there. So it means, you know, corruption and whatever. Let me try to find that paper. I don't know where I have this here. Mahatma Gandhi. I had, Krishna, I hope I didn't forget that. I was going to give some examples about these. Oh, Krishna, I didn't take that with me. So then I have to just do it out of my head, which is a little difficult, but Krishna, it's too bad. I'd taken only the captions, I mean the captions and some of the important parts of these clippings, and I wanted to avoid to get into a lot of bulk. But it seems I've forgotten this here. So anyway, so I'm just, there was an incident just recently in May about a young person, and the caption says, "Boyfriend from Hell." Now, I'm just reading it out to you. There was a jilted lover puts girlfriend's pictures on adult website with a cell number after she turns down his proposal. Unable to handle the rejection from his girlfriend, a 25-year-old man put up her pictures on and her mobile number on several adult websites with the message that she was available for sex for 200 rupees per hour. That's called Boyfriend from Hell. And soon the girl, the victim, was flooded with calls from prospective customers who refused to believe her when she told them that this picture and the message on the website was a mistake. And when the calls became so unbearable that the girl eventually had to go to the parents. Her parents did not know she had a boyfriend. And but it seems that the parents were going to help her despite whatever that she rebelled against them and just, you know, took a boyfriend without their consent like that. So this is a case of, and then it was brought to the police and the person was put into jail and put to justice. And but here you can see that this is a rebellion of a child, and she goes, you can see on the piece of paper again, she rebels against the convention. What is the convention, particularly in India? That girls should not have boyfriends before they get married. Not a decent girl will have a boyfriend before she gets married. And if so, she may face rejection from the parents and the family. She may be ostracized from her family and may have to manage on her own. That is still here in India very much common. So that is one kind of rebellion. And the next, we can discuss it further a little later. The next thing is we had once in Bhaktivedanta Hospital a boy. He came from a Brahmin family from Mathura, and I guess there was not much opportunity for him to get a job in Mathura, so he came to Bombay. But even in Bombay you couldn't find a job. I guess his education, I don't know what his education was, but he ended up becoming a taxi driver. And as a taxi driver, he met a girl that he fell in love with and wanted to marry later on. The parents did not agree to that because she was not from a Brahmin caste, and they totally rejected that. So he rebelled against the parents and took Bagan, rat poison, and was admitted in the hospital. So I was helping to counsel that boy, and fortunately he was saved, and we were starting to counsel him. He was not immediately admitting, he was not himself admitting, but his boyfriend was his friend was telling me that it was over a girl. I mean, you can kind of guess, you know, usually taking of, suicide attempts often are over some love affair or some disappointment not reaching the marks in school or whatever, you know. So he was not a college student, so I suppose that it was that. But I didn't press him for it because he was offering it. But he felt, I asked him if he felt comfortable if I would talk to him a little bit. And he said yes, and so then I started talking to him, general topic. I could not go specifically because he was not revealing it, but I was talking about the value of the human form of life, and when there's difficulties, whom to take shelter of. And I reminded him of his, you know, tradition of being a devotee of Lord Krishna, like that, and that. And then later on I also pointed out, if there was a girl, where is she now? You're in difficulties and she's not even coming to visit you. So is this love real love, or is it lust? And is that really worth it to give your life up for that? And more so, the material body that we are getting is actually a gift from God, especially human form of life. Because in this human form of life, we can understand our relationship with the Lord. And so I talked to him in that way, and he started to soften, and I gave him some literatures, our literatures, Srimad Bhagavatam, not the whole set, just the first canto, with the translation of Srila Prabhupada and his purports, like that. So he took it and he was grateful. He was a little grateful. He became like more peaceful at the end. So Then I wanted to give also some political a background on some political issues. Like, of course, Mahatma Gandhi is the traditional hero in the Indian culture for rebellion on all levels, actually. But even before him, you would be surprised to hear, but the Supreme Lord, as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he appeared as the devotee, he was also rebelling in an organized civil disobedience movement. They were living in Bengal, and it was under the rulership of a Qazi, of a Nawab. And this Qazi was getting complaints about the Harinam that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was conducting. And so they were smashing the madrangas of the devotees and dispersing them and being violent to them. Actually, we have experienced a lot of that also in the West when we were doing Sankirtan and book distribution. Particularly in those days, you know, there were some other Indian personalities that claimed to be gurus. There were, anyway, I don't want to name names, but Bhagavan, Rajneesh Bhagavan, and he had many Rolls Royces, and he was acting in many degraded ways. And we were trying to distribute the authorized books of Lord Krishna, Bhagavad Gita, and Srimad Bhagavatam, and so many books. So then they were lumping us in with these kind of quote-unquote cults, what they called cults. And we had to always point out, this is not a cult, this is a culture, a spiritual culture. And we had to face a lot of opposition because of that. But this is expected. It started with Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When we're in a spiritual movement, we have sometimes some opposition to deal with. But to rebel against that is good, because Srila Prabhupada says rebelling in Krishna consciousness against materialism means, and to preach Krishna consciousness means to put a bomb in the lap of Maya. It's like throwing out bombs, you know. It's like war. It's war, you know. Because what are we attacking? We're attacking their mentality, their deepest convictions, you know, of the wonderful things of materialistic life, you know. What you know, all the things that they enjoy and work so hard for is what we are attacking, you know. No illicit sex, no gambling, no meeting, no intoxication. This is what they live for, you know. So we have to expect that. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the inaugurator of the Sankirtan movement, so he also organized the civil disobedience movement. So now you can see rebellion is not so bad, it just has to be for the right cause. Like, if you hear rebellion, you may think, you know, I'm trying to kind of get down on you. No, it's not like that. It's just like we want to understand this properly, this phenomenon, when we should rebel and what we should rebel against, like that. So, and then the next one, more recent issue. Oh, no, we wanted to talk about Mahatma Gandhi. Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi is very much closely related to our Guru Maharaj. Our Guru Maharaj was a follower. He is almost a contemporary of Gandhi, a little older. Gandhi is a little older and Prabhupada is a little younger. But he was his follower, and as a young man, he was wearing khadi, which was the insignia of the nationalists. You know, he was a great nationalist. And when he met his Guru Maharaj, the first thing his Guru Maharaj was saying to him, "You're an educated young man, why don't you preach Krishna consciousness in the Western countries?" And the first argument Prabhupada gave was, "How can I preach effectively if we are under a foreign subjugation? No one in the world will listen to us. We are dominated by the British, and how can we first of all have to get our freedom, and then people will listen to us?" So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, he was saying, "No, this is too urgent. this, to become Krishna conscious, the mission of Krishna consciousness is too urgent. It can't wait till the politics move the way you want them to. And this preaching has to go on despite whatever happens in politics. So he urged him and he convinced him finally about the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he always said that he was happy to be defeated by his Guru Maharaj in this way. And but he had a lifelong kind of a, how do you say, somewhat of a commitment to Gandhi also, because he was honored and looked up to by people all around the world for his somewhat saintly qualities. Of course, there's many things Prabhupada said that were, he was, you know, just like people always say, Mahatma Gandhi was a saint amongst politicians, but a politician amongst saints. So we are, with Prabhupada, he's the saint, so he could detect what the pitfalls were of his movement and his teachings, you know, what he was teaching and the message he was giving to the people. The one particular one, which is one of the biggest things he was working throughout his life, was the non-violent, non-cooperation, disobedience movement against the Britishers, you know. But now, and he was at the same time, he was professing to be a lover of the Bhagavad Gita, and he probably was to his own, in his own way. But unfortunately, this does not go in, along with the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, his non-violence in politics, and it is against, practically against what Krishna himself taught. What is the Bhagavad Gita? The Bhagavad Gita is the things that Krishna taught on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, as the place of violence. And he incited Arjuna to be violent. Because in politics, violence is required. If there's a party that is disobedient to the laws of God and commits offenses and harm to other living, of God, he is actually disqualified to be in that position. So there has to be violence, there has to be some measures to take him out of that position. And that was Krishna's determination, to take him out of that, to take the Kauravas out of that position of leadership. They were not qualified. But his devotees, Arjuna and the Pandavas, they were highly qualified, and he wanted them to see them enthroned so for the benefit of the people. So Prabhupada always says, you know, Mahatma Gandhi's attempt of non-violence was like cooking, trying to cook without fire. Politics without violence is useless. So, because that's what it means, kshatriya, one who cuts down the elements, the opposing elements like that, you know. And the second thing, Mahatma Gandhi was rebelling also against the caste system. He wanted the Bangis to be having the same, he wanted them to have the same opportunities as all others. He wanted that caste system to be removed because he saw the evil of it. And in some, if the caste system is corrupted and it is not practiced in accordance to Krishna's teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, then it is harmful and it is unfortunately, the whole world is against it. And looks down upon it, because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, guna karma vibhagasha, that the vanasham dharma, or the four social and four spiritual statuses, they're decided on the basis of quality and work, like that, not according to one janma and like that, not according to birthright. So this birthright concept of the caste system is what really corrupted the whole thing. And Mahatma Gandhi didn't really understand that properly, and therefore artificially he tried to make the Bangis put them on an equal level. They were in those days prevented from going into the temples, but and he labeled them Haridans. But actually, Prabhupada points out the title Harijan is a very elevated title. It means a person who is a pure devotee of the Lord, who is the man of Lord Hari, who is the servant of Lord Hari. That is a very, very high kind of a position to give a person. Just by rubber stamping him, this cannot be possible like that. So actually, he was defeated on all levels. Even though he was living, our Guru Maharaj was actually writing a letter to him just before his assassination to ask him to, I read some of that to you. He asked him to please give this up, despite your all the things that you've attempted for in life, the non-violence and in politics, and you know, Prabhupada felt that. Or it is recognized by others as well, that even though Gandhi was getting some public sympathy by his non-violence in politics, but ultimately the freedom was established by the violence that Subhash Chandra Bose took up to drive the British out of this country. Like that. It was the violence, it was not the non-violence that actually earned the freedom for India. And Prabhupada told Gandhi, so now on all levels you have experienced defeat and opposition like this, but you always propose to be a lover of the Bhagavad Gita, so take this up and give up this rotten politics, he called it. And he made even some prediction. He said, my dear friend Mahatmaji, please accept my respectful namaskar. I'm your unknown friend, but I had to write to you at this time, at times and again, although you never cared to reply them. I sent you my papers back to Godhead. This was in 1947, just before the assassination of Gandhiji. But your secretaries told me that you have very little time to read the letters and much less for reading the magazines. I asked for an interview with you, but your busy secretaries never care to reply this. Anyway, as I am I'm your very old friend, although unknown to you, I'm again writing to you in order to bring you to the rightful position deserved by you. As a sincere friend, I must not deviate from my duty towards a friend like you and your good selves. I tell you, as a sincere friend, that you must immediately retire from this active politics if you do not desire to die an unglorious death. The honor and prestige that you have obtained during the course of your present lifetime were not possible to be obtained by anyone else within the living memory. Now, by the grace of God, that illusion is going to be cleared. And thus your faithful friend like Acharya Kripalini and others are accusing you for your inability to present for your inability at the present moment to give them any political program. You should therefore take a note of warning from your insignificant friend like me that unless you retire timely from politics and engage yourself 100% in the preaching work of Bhagavad Gita, which is the real function of the Mahatmas, you shall have to meet with such inglorious death as Mussolini, Hitler, Tojo, Churchill and Lloyd George met with. You can very easily understand as how some of your political enemies in the garbs of friends have deliberately cheated you and have broken your heart by doing the same mischief for which you have struggled for so many years. He's pointing out one of the things also Gandhi always wanted was the Hindu-Muslim unity. And Prabhupada explains that the British deliberately poked into that relationship and brought disunity, corrupt within this field, and finally Pakistan and India was divided like that. God, and then he puts it very nicely, you wanted to do something to uplift the position of the Bangis, but they are still rotting as Bangis, even though you are living in the Bangi colony. God has favored you by dissipating the illusion you were hovering in, and by the same illusion you were nursing those ideas of truth. The truth with which you have been experimenting for so long is relative. And then he explains what is real truth, and then he explains that the Katya Upanishad said that one should approach a bona fide spiritual master. And he points out that if you would have taken a bona fide spiritual master according to the instruction of the Vedas, you would have avoided many of these illusions. And you would have, instead of speculating on the truth. So that is what we are seeing here. He was on the Manomaya platform. He was not coming up to the Vigyan platform. He was on the Manomaya platform, speculating on the absolute truth, having very much attraction to the Bhagavad Gita, but had no access to it. It takes a spiritual master to have access to spiritual knowledge. And then, by that knowledge, we can actually avoid so many problems in life. And the fourth presentation about rebellion is the more recent issue that was going on for about a month about pro-quota and anti-quota policies that the government was taking up, and there's constant rebellion and writing was going on. I heard on the 13th of May, I was in Vrindavan Dham at that time, some students here in Bombay rioted in Azad Maidan, and they were becoming more and more excited. There were about 300 students, and they went all the way to Raj Bhavan in Valkeshwar, Malabar Hills, and there they formed the human chain to block the traffic, and they handed out pamphlets about the anti-quota policies and their objection to it and whatever, and they had signs. Unfortunately, I don't have them here right now, but I remember some of them had all kinds of different signs. One said everyone should get seats, but in higher education colleges, but it should be on the basis of merit. They were demanding merit. And then I have to do it out of the top of my head. I don't know where my notes are, but anyway, so as they were protesting, handing out, then that one sign that was really funny, I had to laugh, it sounded almost American. Who in hell is he to decide our future? It sounded like an American, you know, rebel, you know. In America, the people are very crude and outspoken, you know. And there was a sign with a skull and with a crisscross bones, and Arjun Singh's name under there, the HRD minister, sorry, Human Resource Development. And he's apparently the person who was insisting on pro-quota and was very adamant about it, you know, not wanting to hear any, you know, something like that. So they were seeing him as a culprit and like that, so... And it says, Brahmin ho ya SC ho, SC standing I guess for schedule castes, you know, Brahmin ho ya CS ho, SCs ho, Bharat egi hai. Keval bas yehi problem bas yehi hai ki har ek neta har hamara neta nakal how do you say fake hai, fake matlab nakal hai. So he saw it's amongst us, you know, the pro-quota and anti-quota people, there is no problem, it's you, the leaders, you know. There were all kinds of signs like that. And then finally, you know, in front of Rajbhavan, they're brutally beaten down, bloody charged, and there was some senior officer that was involved that was even... It kept even beating them after they were already falling down, and then they were commissioned... Then the police in chief was commissioned to get a report on that, why it happened and whatever, and all these things. So it was all kinds of waves of rebellion here and there, you know. So here, this is a very classical and recent example of rebellion against the constitution, you know, which they and most of all, the students recognize, and even the, what was his name? There's some, the who was the person that even openly declared one of the governors even himself declared it was the Congress that played caste cards. He called it caste cards, you know, for narrow electoral gains. And the students were disgusted by this kind of consciousness of getting votes, you know, vote-playing games, you know. So it's different parties, you know. The students, they may have their own view, and the government has their own view, and the government is very hypocritical. They're acting like they're interested in the lower castes, but actually they have their own gain in mind. Naturally, the students will rebel, you know. This is what we're reading here, remember? Talks about rebelling against the authorities of the of a constituted government. So they're trying to make this constitution that anyone gets these seeds, you know. I guess getting these seeds in those SC and OBCs from those ranks, you know, I guess they don't have to get an admission, they don't have to get some particular admission exam or something, while others have, it seems. I'm not quite familiar, but then, of course, the pro-quota people, they're saying, you know, we have for generations we have been suppressed, and now finally we're getting the opportunity to go get into higher education, but still we have to face so much opposition. We are constantly ridiculed and like that, and we don't have the same opportunities because we may not have money for coaching courses and this and that and whatever. And they're saying that it's not that we don't have to come up with merits also. We also have to come up with merits, you know, so why are we not accepted properly? So they have all their different views like that. But in the matter of that, in their rebellion, they were hurt. They were this half of these people that were rebelling there. There were women. Even the women were slapped by the police. And there some incident of some physically challenged person that was hit and falling on the ground and hurt. And he was taken to the police and was not attended to. Medically not attended to for 5 hours after that. So all kinds of cruelties are happening in these kind of incidents of rebellion. So now I'm coming to the point of where I want you to kind of help me with the equation. So what do you see in all the examples that I've given on rebellion? What is the common thing there? Can you see something that is common in all these four things, four examples? Or do you know any, have you personally or some friends of yours ever participated in any kind of rebellion against some constitution or some personal rebellion in family life, etc.? Can you think of something like that? I give you a little hint. Do you think that these people, I mean, the aim, it seems, in the motivation in every living entity's life is to be happy, right? Isn't it? Agree to that? Even we can find that drive in the animals. So the reason why a person rebels is because they don't agree to some kind of convention or some kind of some government decisions like that. And because why? Because they're being cheated or being, you know, so they feel they will be in a disadvantageous position where they can't enjoy life as they could, right? In this case, you know, in the pro and anti quota case, they cannot, some may not get seats, particularly in medical college. Are any of you medical students? Can you raise your hand? Any medical students here? So, you know, they were particularly involved because I guess the competition to get into medical seats is more than, you know, in engineering technical colleges. So they're rebelling because their education, their future may be hampered like that, or delayed at least. You know, they may not get in the seat this year. They may have to apply again next year. You know, so by this rebellion, do they achieve something, what they're expecting, or do you think there's some positive gain in all this rebellion, or do you think there's it results in some, it is a waste of time or something? So my question is, now we can see, we want to see what is the outcome. The equation means one element plus another element equals something else, right? So we have agreed on that we all want to be happy, right? Is that what we're seeing in the first case of the girlfriend with the boyfriend of hell, right? Was she happy after she took that friend and had this experience with this boy? No, she was in great distress and anxiety, and it was funny confiding in her parents like that. So, and it could have ended up much more dangerously, you know. So we have, so we're agreeing by seeing the example of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, rebellion is not bad. Just it needs to be for the right cause, right? And the equation should end up to be happiness. But how do we get this situation? In these situations, we could see they had their reasoning. They had their reasoning why they were going to rebel. But so we have material reasoning here, and rebellion, plus rebellion, but it equals to distress. So this is not the equation we want to come up. Huh? Yeah, this is not what we want to come up with, right? So we want to the equation to equal to satisfaction, right? So where the question mark is, what do you think could be put in there? factor, what word could be put there to equal to add up with rebellion to equal satisfaction? Some idea? Huh? Very good. You got it right. The first person got it right. Wonderful. Spiritual reasoning. Very right. So now, just we're finishing it off. Spiritual reasoning is what is required for us to end up to be satisfied with our rebellion. So I was thinking in that terms with the original rebellion is actually when we are coming from the spiritual world, rebelling against the Supreme Lord, and the Vedic literatures explain how the living entity has freedom, and because of this freedom, and actually I wanted to point out this is this knowledge of the Vedic literatures describing the living entities, how it comes in the material world and how it also can go back to the spiritual world, is very wonderful. I came from Christianity and there's not such information at all available. They have the theory, I mean in all religions they have their some kind of a theory, you know, like the Adam and Eve, you know, how she took from the apple from the garden, I don't know, of Eden, if you know that, but it is not at all, it doesn't click properly, it doesn't give proper understanding. But this understanding how we are spirit soul actually, and the soul is a person and has a relationship with God, and because of that relationship, which is the relationship of love, there has to be freedom, because whenever there is love, there must be also freedom. Otherwise, love cannot bloom, cannot blossom to its fullest. You know, creativity in love, how to do something more and more nice for the beloved, is only there when the freedom is there. If someone twists your arm and says, "You love me, otherwise I'm gonna," you know, like that, then who will want to love that kind of a person? You know, sometimes in family relationships here in the material world, we find that, you know, that people want to force us to love them and serve them. Sometimes I heard the sas and sasuras are like that for the girls. Not all, but you know, sometimes. But so love has to be voluntary. It has to be an attraction there. So because of that, when we have freedom though, then also sometimes we may choose or not choose to love. And so at that point the living entity falls into the material world, rebelling against the Lord. And then it has to face all the things here in the material world that are really even worse than, you know, than the situation that he came from. Much, much difficult. And he, in fact, Krishna is the most wonderful psychologist. He puts the living entity in a position where he experienced rebellion by others. Like, for example, as a parent. You know, the parent of the girl who had a boyfriend from hell. The parent, they must have suffered so much, you know. And maybe sometimes then that inkling comes, you know. You know, I originally did this to Krishna. Now I have a child that does that to me, you know. Like that, you know. So then maybe that kind of sparkles their remembrance of Krishna, you know, when there's intense suffering of the parents like that. So Krishna is a wonderful psychologist. And so now, what is the thing that took us away from the Lord? It was the mind. The mind took control and said, you have so much better opportunity. Just like we were reading earlier on the Manomaya stage, what is the function of the mind? Acceptance and rejectance. Sometimes we accept something to be very wonderful. So we accepted the association of the Lord very wonderful and the devotees in the spiritual world. But then at one point, we wanted to try something else. Maybe, just like they say in America, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, right? So we wanted to try out to see what's on the other side of the fence. But we had a bad experience. So now we have to take the very mind The mind is actually not a person, it's just a tool. It's a tool. Just like when you have a ladder. The ladder has steps. And you can choose either go up in the steps or you can go down in the steps. So we chose to go down on the steps. But now you can use the same ladder. Use the same ladder and go up on the steps. So the mind has told us, dictated to us, come to the material world, just see what you can enjoy here, this and that and whatever else. And now we are taking control and we're saying, no, you listen to me, I'm your master. And we're starting to dictate to the mind. And how do we do that? By spiritual reasoning. Using this equation, the spiritual reasoning, to convince the mind, to help us to find our way back to the spiritual world. And so the spiritual reasoning is very, very, very necessary. And how do we learn how to reason properly? And that is by, first of all, taking the association of the devotees and learning from them and hearing the words of the Lord from Bhagavad Gita and from the great devotees, hearing from the scriptures, and then gradually our intelligence develops and we're coming more and more to the Vijnanmaya platform where we can actually recognize what is our soul and our relationship with the Supreme Lord. So does this sound like a practical plan? If we can always remember this equation of spiritual reasoning plus rebellion equals satisfaction. So thank you for listening. I probably have overdrawn a little bit, but I was a little perplexed because I didn't have my notes with me, some of my notes. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
If there's any question or so, if there's no time now, you can ask me also later on. Maybe I can, whatever you decide.